There's a lot to be asked of our teachers today, and here's another thing to add to that list: the ability to recognize a student's cultural background. I'm Jabalani LaFall, and on today's Central Standard, we're joined by Dr. Geneva Gay, an expert in multicultural education. Dr. Gay was the featured speaker earlier this month at UMKC's Urban Education and Community Forum, which drew a record number of attendance. Perhaps her most interesting view is her belief that caring for students is a pedagogical necessity in a school system that's increasingly diverse. She's also keen on ideas of how to recognize different communication styles depending on cultural backgrounds.
We have not given the kind of attention to how culture influences learning behavior as we need to. And until we do that, we are not going to close the achievement gaps.
Join us in teasing out the intricacies of a culturally sensitive education. All ahead on Central Standard after this hour's news. When it comes to issues of cultural diversity, how can we better educate our educators? And if we don't, in an era of increased globalization, what are the ramifications of not educating our educators? This is Central Standard. I'm Jabalani LaFall. We're joined today by an expert in multicultural education, Geneva Gay, professor of curriculum and instruction at the University of Washington at Seattle. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Now, what is culturally responsive teaching and multicultural education?
Basically, culturally responsive teaching is the idea of using the background experiences, the heritages, the cultures, if you will, of students from different ethnic, racial, and cultural backgrounds as points of reference, as resources for teaching them much more effectively. You could kind of synop that idea by saying culturally responsive teaching is teaching children through who they are, rather than trying to teach students instead of who they are. There is a close relationship between multicultural education and culturally responsive teaching in the sense that multicultural education is a larger domain, and it will include dimensions of education other than teaching, whereas culturally responsive teaching takes out that aspect that deal with the instructional process and emphasize that.
This definitely seems like a daunting task, educating an educator to be culturally responsive. How do you go about doing that?
Well, I think there are several ways. It is indeed complex, it's challenging, and there is a lot of resistance to it, but I would argue that it is absolutely imperative and necessary. And I think one way in which we begin to do that is to make cultural responsive teaching and or multicultural education a mandatory feature of teacher certification. Because we know that from research and common experience that many teachers won't do what is the important and necessary thing to do unless it is required. So I would think that one of the first things to do is state certification agencies and universities that deliver instructional programs for teacher preparation, that multicultural education should be a fundamental part of those. It should be required. So having done that, then there are many different ways in which you can design elements of diversity within those teacher education programs. So, for example, if you look at a typical teacher education program, there will be elements that are required, for example, courses and experiences that are required, and then there are courses and experiences that are elective. So I would suggest is that multicultural education should not be within the elective domains, but they should be in those required courses. I won't dare to try to say at this point how many courses that should be required, but without question, there some should be as a mandatory part of teacher preparation program. Another kind of element of teacher preparation is that students in training to become teachers almost everywhere throughout the country will be expected to have what we call some kind of practicum experiences. That is that they will spend time in settings that either will be schools or approximation of schools. So some deliberate efforts should be undertaken to make sure that those practicum experiences are located in communities, in schools, where there are children from different ethnic and racial and cultural backgrounds, so that pre-service teachers become accustomed in their training processes to get used to these encounters.
And Dr. Gay, you argue that this improves achievement, why is it believed that this type of preparation on being culturally responsive as a teacher and fostering multicultural education, why do you believe that improves achievement?
For a number of reasons. One of them, common sense says that people perform better in situations and under circumstances that they're familiar with, that they feel comfortable with. I mean, we know this from long-time research in psychology and related fields. So if you have cultural responsive education and multicultural education in schools, that would suggest then that the school programs, the school dynamics, the school climate would reflect a lot of contributions and images and representations of people from different ethnic and cultural backgrounds. So when students from these groups come into those environments, they would see themselves reflected in the curriculum materials. They would see experiences being written into how teachers teach, the kinds of things that they're being tested on that might be familiar with them. And that familiarity will encourage folks to focus more intently on the tasks that are given as far as learning.
What educational needs will this address in the real world level after practicum, after education, after credentialing? What educational needs does this type of program address? Why is it necessary for certain students?
Well, first of all, multicultural education is necessary for all students. And what will happen is the kind of skills, the skill sets that students acquire while they're in schools, for example, not just skills related to specific subjects, but things that transcend subjects. For example, problem solving, critical thinking, how to engage in quality social and personal interactions, how to develop confidence and efficacy in one's own capabilities. Those things that may be developed while in school then will transfer in settings out of school, whether in the work environment and what have you, so that people will have a higher level of personal confidence in their own capability. Some people will talk about the idea of risk-taking. So when students leave schools and colleges and they go into careers, there is a high level of risk in any career that you're taking. And that risk may be nothing more than willing to work at one level and then to progress through that career by going to another level, to step out of a comfort zone into another area that you're not so comfortable with. So that requires a sense of personal confidence, the capability to engage in risk-taking, to monitor yourself as you work through these kinds of experiences and these kind of interactions. So if all of those skills then have been developed while in school, and the argument of multicultural education is those skills can be accomplished to a higher degree of mastery when students are working with issues and circumstances and situations that are ethnically and culturally pluralistic. So all of those things don't get left behind when you leave school, but you carry them with you as, if you will, we say in education, as tool sets for your life experiences.
So this is not necessarily about sensitivity, but
no,
more about a wide-ranging understanding.
Absolutely. Wide-ranging of knowledge acquisition, of skill development, of how to engage in different kinds of issues or problem solving. So it's a misunderstanding that many people say when you're talking about multicultural education, it's just being sensitive about other people. Now, this domain is very, very grounded in knowledge and skills, not just emotional kinds of experiences, if you will.
What are some examples of how a teacher can overgeneralize or over-stereotype a student, or maybe even try to be too culturally sensitive?
I think one of the things that happens is so much of what we think we know about cultural diversity, unfortunately, we have to acquire it through the mass media. And the mass media is primarily set up to entertain as opposed to inform. So what happens is when you look at those kinds of things, the primary sources of information for most of us as citizens don't give us a full-fledged range of what people's lives are like from different social classes, from different racial backgrounds and what have you. So what we have then is when we come into these relationships, we have very narrow slices of wide-ranging lived experiences. So the tendency then is to take this little peekaboo view of people's lives and then assume that that is all there is to it and that every person within an ethnic group will exhibit that behavior that we think we know about the group in the same way. So that's the danger of overgeneralizing from a small set of information to greater, wide-ranging, diverse people within ethnic groups.
It's interesting that you mentioned that. I think immediately of Dangerous Minds or one of those movies where a teacher of a Caucasian background comes in and finds themselves in the role of saving ethnic students mm-hmm. or bringing out the educational aptitude in those ethnic students when before nobody cared about them, and that sort of being an influence of the way people see urban schools in general. How does, in that vein, how does mass media influence the way teachers teach?
Oh, my. I think mass media, as I started to say earlier on, is the source of much information that many people have about people and experiences that they have not lived, that they're unfamiliar with. And mass media can't teach all that needs to be taught. So what happens then is that teachers come into interactions with students from different racial backgrounds with these notions about what is racial differences and how people live those experiences based on what they've learned through, let's say, pop magazines, through cinema, theater, through television programs, etc. And they just don't have the kind, they meaning teachers then, don't have the kind of depth of knowledge nor the range of knowledge that they need in order to translate that understanding into information that guides their instructional strategies. So as a result then, teachers perpetuate, unfortunately, stereotypic notions about what kids from different backgrounds are all about.
So how does the concept of a culturally responsive teaching or multicultural education environment take back the conversation in terms of what's called a societal curriculum? How do you then take back that societal curriculum and tailor it away from what the media is exposing?
Well, I think one of the ways in which we do that is to, first of all, concede the importance of the societal curriculum, the media, if you will, media in a broad sense, that it is that those experiences, those sources of being are critical parts of all of our lives. So it's nonsense to pretend that they're not going to exist. So I think one of the things that we want to do then is to look at what the societal curriculum is doing and what it contributes and what it can't contribute. So I would say in teacher preparation, we begin by doing a careful analysis of what the societal curriculum is able to do and what it's not is able to not do. And then talk about what is it that we in teacher preparation need to do to complement and to correct and to extend the societal curriculum, not to just pretend that it doesn't exist.
Well, what have you found out so far about what the societal curriculum does and doesn't do? Where does the societal curriculum end and the educational or scholastic curriculum begin?
I think what the societal curriculum does is give an introduction and a superficial one. Societal curriculum will tend to give teachers and other people an introduction to what we would call the more the ritualistic and the ceremonial aspects of curriculum, you know, for example, ceremonies or elements of stylistic features of culture and all of that. But what the societal curriculum does not do is get into the interior components of curriculum, what some scholars would call those intangible aspects of curriculum, such as values, beliefs, attitudes, communication styles, and what have you. And societal curriculum doesn't necessarily deal with those from an analytical point of view. They may present profiles of some aspects of those, but not an informative, instructional piece of how they came to be, why do they exist, how do they affect and translate in a learning context. So in teacher preparation, we would want to take what the societal curriculum begins and then continue that agenda into greater depth, to deeper insight, to broader ranges of experiences. And of course, what does all of this mean in the context of teaching and learning?
Dr. Gay, when you say ritualistic approach versus practical or intangible approach, give us some examples of instances in the ritualistic approach and then some examples in the intangible approach that you just compared and contrasted.
For example, a ritualistic approach, let's say in communication. Communication is a critical dimension of every people's culture, but different cultures engage in communication in different ways. So a ritualistic feature of communication might be, what are the latest vogue, popular, cool words and phrases that are in for this particular generation? That's ritualistic. That's if you will, style, you know, kind of stuff. But if we wanted to, what we want to do then, if we get into the depth of cultural communication, would not only talk about what might be the voguish words now, but is there a pattern and trend across history of how words and phrases are generated? Why do those words and phrases come about? The other thing is that we, as we look closer and deeper at communication, we wouldn't just stop with words and phrases. That's just one aspect of communication. We might look at rhythm. We might look at nuances. We might look at embedded meaning. We might look at symbolic speech as opposed to vocalized speech and all of this. So we would get deeper into those kinds of things. We would talk about how people organize thought and prepare presentation of ideas. All of these would be elements of communication, whereas there was really would be no reason for the societal curriculum to get into those kind of details, because that's not the purpose of the societal curriculum, or in this case, media as part of societal curriculum.
You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 KCUR, streaming live on KCUR.org. I'm Jabalani LaFall. Our guest today is Dr. Geneva Gay, Professor of Curriculum and Instruction at the University of Washington at Seattle. Now, Dr. Gay, how does a teacher's standards influence a student's success?
Teaching standards?
A teacher's standards.
Oh, a
individual
teacher's standards. We have long since known that what teachers believe about students and teacher's standards are, you could think of that as a translation of beliefs and attitudes and expectations. So we have long since known that what teachers believe about students, they act on it and translate those beliefs into behaviors in the classroom. So if teachers if a teacher standard is all kids in my class will perform and I'll do everything to my within my realm of possibility to ensure that they will achieve on some positive and high levels, then students will perform very highly in those teachers' classrooms. Just as teachers who say, well, you know, certain kids, they simply cannot, they can't learn really sophisticated knowledge and all of that. Then what teachers will do is they will scale their instructional strategies down so that children don't perform very well. So teacher standards are absolutely critical. They are crucial in setting the ambiance, setting the dynamic, the level of engagement that would happen in that classroom. As we say kind of informally, students either live up or they live down to what teachers expect and the kind of orientation that they meaning teachers, set into place in those classrooms.
On the track of that same train of thought, you've written and espoused that caring is a moral imperative and a social responsibility and a pedagogical, you know, necessity. Many teachers come from a position of caring, but how do you take that further?
To me, first of all, I want to help people to understand that my notion of caring is not the warm, fuzzy kind of thing, you know, but rather caring for me is an action-driven idea. When you genuinely care not about someone, but when you care for someone, then you do all that you can to help that person be the best person they can be. So that means then is that for teachers, caring teachers are diligent and persistent and imaginative and creative about finding alternative ways to help students perform better in what they are expected to do, and that is to learn.
And that goes back to what you said about shooting for performance rather than shooting for adequate.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
One aspect of culturally responsive teaching is to understand different ethnic groups' communication styles, as we've been talking a little bit. You call this double jeopardy, when students need to learn the material while also trying to fit and meld to the teaching style. Talk a little bit about that.
Well,
double jeopardy.
The idea of double jeopardy is when you have to learn content and you also have to learn protocol. And what I mean by protocol is the style and the ritual and the stuff around that surround the engagement with content or substance. OK, so if students don't know, or if one does not know the protocols and, the, if you will, rituals that surround the task to perform, then you have to learn the ritual as a prelude to engaging in the task. And if you don't know the protocols, the rituals around the task, you'll never get to, if you will, the content of the task. So, for example, many students, ethnically and racially diverse students, don't know how to take standardized testing. Now, understand what I said. I'm not talking about they don't know the content. That's a different issue. They may or may not know the content, but they don't know the ritual, the style, the procedures for test taking.
It's a lot more passive. Let's take the African-American and Latino communities, for example, one that I'm very familiar with, and the Black community in general that you're very familiar with. The call and response culture is a way that we learn in the context of what we've talked about today as societal curriculum. The call and response, receiving information based on a call and response, based on a very interactive sort of framework. So how then do you take that framework and educate a teacher on understanding that framework and translating it to a more passive environment of a standardized test?
Then I think what you do is then you teach teachers to understand in a conscious way what is the style of communication in schools. Because teachers might be immersed in that style of communication, but don't necessarily understand it in any kind of deliberate and intentional way. I mean, that's a common kind of dilemma of cultural being. While you are deeply immersed as a member of a culture, you might not cognitively understand and be able to articulate that. So the same thing is true, let's say, with African-American students. So they may be deeply immersed in this call-response, interactive communicative style, but don't know it in order to, in a sense of being able to explain it and articulate it to someone else. So then I think what we have to do with teachers is help have to, first of all, understand structurally and systematically these different learning styles, these different communication styles, and then talk about where are the points of conflict and the points of connection between the two. And from that point, teachers should be able to see now here are points of collision between school style of communication and, let's say, African-American style of communication, and, of course, then other ethnic groups, their own styles of communication. So where are these points of tension among these different communication styles? If you can identify the points of tension, you can then focus intervention strategies to resolve or to minimize those tensions.
What point of tensions have you observed in the current system?
One of them is, for example, you began to mention it earlier on. I would argue that the style of communication in schools tend to be a very linear approach, whereas with African American and also with, let's say, Latino Americans and with Asian Americans, for some reason or another, those groups have elements of communication that are quite common. And that is, rather than a linear approach to communication, it is kind of a circular approach. A linear approach would be I talk, you listen, then you talk, and I listen. Whereas a circular approach is we talk and listen kind of at this appears to be at the same time. Or you have three or four people talking on different levels and different engagements or gradation at the same time. So what you would want to do then is teachers have to almost learn how to teach students how to take their circular approach to communication and reorganize it to fit a linear approach. Now, in order to do that, you have to find out what are some elements that are in the circle of that communication, and then maybe begin to say, what of those elements can be negotiated, rather than simply trying to say to students who do engage in circular interactive communication, that won't fit in school, so stop it.
It's interesting that you bring that up, because there seems to be a systemic phenomenon that takes student instruction from a circular process to a linear process. Mm-hmm. If you notice in preschools and kindergartens and Montessori schools, children are actually sitting in a circle and participating in a circle. But as they get older, the process is more linear. They're sitting in rows and columns and being dictated to and called upon. Is that sort of something that contributes to the current system now?
Without question. Human beings are socialized. Culture is about socialization. It's not something that's biologically inherited. So we are taught to be as we are, and we can be retaught to be in different kinds of ways. And we teach. Teaching is not just about vocalizing, but we teach symbolically. In my area of education, we very often would talk about symbolic teaching is very often called the hidden curriculum. So when we place children in how we organize space in learning situation, it's part of the symbolic or the hidden curriculum, because we are sending implicit messages to students about what is appropriate behavior of how to engage here. And your notion about how we start with children in kindergarten and preschool and little circular kinds of stuff and sitting on floors and all of that, and then as they move up the grades, we restructure that is very perceptive and very insightful, and I think that's sending incredible messages. Now, within
what types of messages?
What kind of messages is that? In other words, while you're little, you have more degrees of freedom to not adapt to the institutional presses of our dominant society, and as you grow older, you must conform to the prevailing norm. And those prevailing norms are governed by the dominant culture in our society. And you don't have certain degrees of freedom the older you get. And that also means then the older you get, you may indeed, if you are not a part of the dominant culture, you have to increasingly compromise your own cultural identity and your cultural experience, which could eventually cause some people to disaffiliate from themselves. And that may not be the healthiest position to be in and all of that. So,
and that's
those
a position
are
many would argue that a lot of students are in America today,
exactly,
disassociated from themselves. You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 KCUR, streaming live on KCUR.org. Our guest is Dr. Geneva Gay. She's an expert in multicultural education and a professor of curriculum and instruction at the University of Washington, Seattle. We're going to take a quick break, but when we return, we'll discuss standardized testing and how the study of multicultural education can improve its efficacy. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Jabalani LaFall. We've been speaking with Dr. Geneva Gay, a professor of curriculum and instruction at the University of Washington, Seattle, about how teachers can use current learning styles of students to shape their education. Speaking of which, Dr. Gay, does your concept of culturally responsive teaching and multicultural education, does this concept meld well with teaching to the standardized test?
It can, but as it currently exists, it may be a bit problematic, because what happens is the standardized testing is set up on a structure or style, a set of assumptions, implicit assumptions, that are not culturally diverse. Those implicit assumptions come from a dominant culture. And if a student is not able to then transfer or shift, I would call it cross-cultural borders, in order to get into the set, the orientation that's required of doing standardized testing, then they're not going to perform very well, because they would go into the standardized testing trying to engage in a testing task the same way that they engage culturally. And when you have those misfits, then that's going to be very problematic for the performance. But it doesn't have to be that way. First of all, standardized testing, people who created all of those kinds of things, need to do some modifications to accommodate cultural diversity.
What types of modifications?
One of the things is the style of the way in which testing is structured. Another thing that we can do is to make some modifications in the administration of testing, the protocols for how you take the test, and not just the content of the test. Why is it necessary for all children on standardized testing to take the test under the same set of circumstances, at the same time, in the same regimented form? In some ways, it makes no sense for children in certain age groups to sit and try to take a test beyond a certain time frame. That makes no sense. Now, I may not know exactly what that time frame is, but people, let's say, who work with young children in first, second, third grade, if they're in classrooms teaching those children, they know that you're not going to have a child sitting for beyond maybe 10 or 15 minutes on any learning task because of the child's capability developmentally at that time to stay focused on tasks for that long. But do we take those things in consideration when they take a standardized test?
And you're saying that no, we don't.
I don't think that we do it as much as we can, as deliberate as we might. The other kind of thing is not all children take tests or learn in the same framework, the same motif. So why couldn't it be that we could have different ways, different styles of administering testing to accommodate a different styles of, if you will, work habits. Work habits in this instance mean learning, ways of engaging in learning. Why do all students taking a test have to go about taking that test in the same way?
What are some other ways that you might administer?
Well, it might to take something as while it's relatively simplistic and symbolic, but to take an idea that you mentioned earlier about the circular kind of thing. So if you have some children that prefer to just know that they appear to be in a group symbolically, then why couldn't you have children sitting in groups to take the tests, rather than everybody have to be in their separate little cubicle called a desk, lined up in rows and all of this? Now, some people might say reorganizing the desk to take a test in circles as opposed to sitting children around a table to take the test, that might not be very important. But in a child's psycho-emotional level of being, it could make a fundamental difference. There are some children that we know that perform much better when they are asked to do oral presentations rather than and demonstration rather than in writing. So why couldn't we put some of the standardized tests, and not just for children who are not English language speakers as a first language, but for other students who English is their only language, they still perform better talking their tasks rather than writing it. So why couldn't they do the tests verbally?
So in this sense, a culture or a cultural background of a student could matter or could play into the effectiveness of the programs that you're talking about.
Absolutely. And it does. To me, one of the reasons why we have not resolved this dilemma that continues about children from different racial backgrounds performing so poorly on standardized tests is because we have not, we meaning educators, have not given the kind of attention to how culture influences learning behavior as we need to. And until we do that, we are not going to close the achievement gaps.
You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 KCUR, streaming live on KCUR.org. I'm Jabulani LaFall, and today we're joined by an expert in multicultural education, Dr. Geneva Gay. Speaking of culture, and not necessarily cultural diversity, but the culture of education and the culture of the education system in this country, what needs to be fundamentally fixed so that we can start closing some of these achievement gaps?
I think educators have got to deal with the fact is that the United States created a system of education years and years ago that reflected a Euro-American background. And from the very beginning, on one level, that's understandable. But from the very beginning, that the education was set up so it excluded people who would not trace their ancestry to some kind of European base. And until we can restructure schooling so that children from various backgrounds are not forced to learn through a European filter, we will continue to perpetuate inequities. So it is simpler and yet it's extremely complex. We have got to create an education system that truly is grounded in plurality.
It is a very interesting and complex topic. Even here in Kansas City, we've had great debates on the effectiveness of African-centered education and what that means and how effective it's been in terms of the test scores and graduation rates and how effective the administration of such education is, even down to ethnic studies programs and how effective they are and whether they're needed and whether they're inclusive or divisive. Where do you stand on issues such as targeting specific ethnic groups and centering that around the curriculum? Do you think that's divisive? Do you think it's needed? Do you think it would work?
Why not? We have done it for one ethnic group all along. Why not do it for other ethnic groups? So when I, as a high school teacher, taught European history, was I not centering a particular ethnic group at that time?
You were.
Of course, it was a cluster of ethnic groups, just as when you talk about Afrocentric curriculum, African Americans or people of African ancestry, we're talking about a cluster of ethnic groups, not just one ethnic group. So we did it for people who were European based or white. Why shouldn't we do, and we continue to do it, so why shouldn't we do similar kinds of things for other ethnic groups? And I don't think that it's necessarily divisive. I think what will happen is it will be much more honest. And it must be much more accurate. And that honesty will then eventually cause us to end up in converging on that. We do the same thing in certain kinds of areas. Let's say for when we are going, when people go to college, they specialize in areas, content areas or disciplines or subjects. And we don't say because your area is physics and my area is art or music, then those things will in automatically cause us to be divisive. But we develop those specialties and we use our specialties when we come together as human beings to, if you will, build deeper and more genuine foundations for our coalescence as humans around this. So why can't we do that? It seems to me that a powerful element of our humanity is not that we are so different, but because not that we are so similar, but we bring our diversities to our human engagement, and those things enriches our human engagement. So why can't we take that as a element of being human and transfer it into schools and do facsimiles of the same thing?
And how do you get educators on board with this sort of process?
Well, you teach teachers as they are expected to be taught. You teach as they expected to teach. So we do the same. We should be doing the same thing with teachers in their training as we expect teachers to do with students when they go in the classroom. And to some extent, we begin that because teachers come into teacher education programs from all over universities as far as degrees and all of this. And then when they get into the programs, we talk about trying to, if you come from history or if you come from biology or you come from science or math, there are some experiences in teacher preparation where that's cross-fertilization. So we don't always have all teach once people who want to become teachers. If you want to be a math teacher, the whole teacher preparation program is not just among math teachers. So math teachers have to interact and engage in some training, some levels of their preparation with teachers from other subject areas. So we are beginning to do that, but then we don't carry that, continue that and transfer it over when we talk about preparation for working with students from different backgrounds. So in some ways, in teacher education, we have incompatibilities because we begin some things, we suggest some assumptions and expectations on some levels of engagement. And then when we go to other levels of training, we don't carry forth the same kind of expectations, and we shift the axis, and we keep going back and forth with these things. So as an example then, when it comes to mastery of subject area, we say that, sure, you need to concentrate in a subject, and then we can have these different subject specialties converge at certain in the teacher preparation. But when it comes to talking about those parts of how do you engage with students as elements of our professional preparation, we then say, well, maybe we don't need you to learn about how do you engage with different students, you know? So that's what I mean by we have kind of a imbalance in our expectations. So we have one set of assumptions when it comes to subject mastery, and another set of assumptions when it comes to working with children.
Or working with children of different cultural backgrounds.
Children of different cultural backgrounds. It would make more sense to try to have these assumptions similar across different levels of engagement. And the assumptions are, I'm talking about your ideological orientations, not the methodological kinds of things.
How then do you start to look at case studies that are good examples of how these different methodologies work? When you're presenting papers or giving talks or educating educators, which is what you do there at the University of Washington, what case studies do you point to on ways in which what you're espousing has worked?
What you would want to do using case studies is to look at what are the concepts or principles within a particular set of experiences that might transfer to other situations, but not in the same way.
Do you have any real-world examples of educational programs you've looked at that could work?
That did work. For example, there is a very powerful case study of working with Native Hawaiian students in the state of Hawaii about adapting teaching and learning to their cultural styles and how positive this could be, positive in a sense of improving performance in all kinds. So it doesn't make sense then to take this case study and try to transfer the particulars of the case study, that is how you operate with Hawaiian students, to, let's say, African Americans in Kansas or Missouri, in Kansas City. So what you would want to do is to say, let's look at what are the process features, what are the principles that can be extrapolated from the Native Hawaiian case study, and let's see if we can take those principles and then use them in Kansas City with, let's say, African Americans or with Latinos, and say, let's take the principle and then get the particular of the African American experience to match the principle. So one of the principles in the Native Hawaiian case study was using the a cultural communication style among Native Hawaiians. So that would be the principle. What is the cultural communication style? And then what you have to do is figure out what is the cultural communication style of, let's say, African Americans in Kansas City schools, and make it specific. Teach that to teachers. And student teachers and pre-service teachers, even before they get to the student teaching level, and classroom teachers who are actively engaged, say, okay, here are the cultural communication style of African Americans. Understand that. Now, let's redesign our teaching so that it has elements of the cultural communication style of African American. You see? So that's the purpose of case study, to amplify principles that are appropriate in particular contexts or for particular populations.
Dr. Gay, you've seen education evolve from segregated schools all the way to what we have now through different eras of the civil rights struggles and different eras of equality in education. And you write that diversity in education is no longer a luxury. What do you mean by that?
I mean that student populations are increasingly diverse, pluralistic, and that phenomena is getting for me, as an advocate of diversity, it's getting better. For some folks that are concerned about it, it's getting worse. In other words, getting more. So students are, the numbers of diversities in schools across the United States are increasingly complex rather than more and more simplified. If you step back 50 years or even 25 years, most certainly 100 years, you could talk about one or two populations in schools. In most cases now, you don't have – that simply is not a luxury now. The other kind of thing is the gap – another gap we don't talk as much about as we should across the board. In some arenas we do. But the gap between who teaches and who's taught – is growing, or it's continuous. Well, actually, it's growing because the greater number of teachers across the United States are of European American ancestry and female. But the students in schools are not European American and just female. They are European American, but they're also Asian and African and Pacific Islander and Middle Eastern, and you keep going on and on and on. So that's one. Another dimension of this diversity that means that it's growing even more is that within the U.S. population and in U.S. schools, students are coming from ethnic and racial and linguistic backgrounds that historically we, meaning the dominant population, we are not accustomed to. So that challenges us even more. In earlier generations, our diversity came from backgrounds that were primarily Western European-based, with exception of African-Americans and Native Americans, what have you. But let's say our immigrant populations were primarily from Western Europe kind of backgrounds. And when you look at the baselines of cultures, U.S. mainstream culture has a Western European baseline. So at least we had a kind of a starting point, a shared starting point. A case example of that would be our language. English, while English physically looks like French, you know, and looks like German, at least the characters do,
and
you
Spanish.
Know, the letters and Spanish. So the but now that's not the increasingly that's not the case. Most of our immigrant population is not coming from Europe, you know. Western-based countries, but they're coming from the greatest number of immigrants are coming from Asian countries. It's coming from increasingly Middle Eastern countries. It's coming from countries that have an Arabic background, like Northeastern African nations, and on it goes. So those diversities are becoming more complex on multiple levels. And yet we are trying to continue to teach these incredibly wide, beautifully diverse children the same way we were trying to teach when we didn't have that kind of diversity. It doesn't make any sense.
Dr. Gay, what are the long-term detriments for the United States and its education system in this era of globalization if we don't adapt to the increasingly diverse populations and the increasing needs of those diverse populations?
I think it would be devastating for the United States as far as its sense of image, trust, and influence in the global community among other countries and all of that. Because I think what will happen increasingly, other countries will look at the United States and judge us in the leadership domains based on what is happening or not happening in our domestic domains. And I think that's already beginning to happen. There are countries, I think, are beginning to ask us, why would you come to us and tell us what to do when you're not able to take care of similar issues on your own home ground? The rest of the world looks to the United States as a place to come for a better life. But I don't think this will prevail unless we do something in the very long run. But there will be other countries that will begin to say, this is a better place for us to migrate, for the world to migrate toward other directions rather than toward the United States.
And what about as a place to live for the citizens who have been here?
Oh, same thing. I know the sort of quality of life is not going to be as good. And I think that people will find, it may very well be, is that we'll see a reverse, if there's such a thing, a reverse migration or immigration with the people who have been in the United States, citizens of the United States for a long term, looking for other place to go to live. Because it just will be so the idea
an exodus,
of,
if you will.
Of expatriateness. Well, this has always been a phenomena in U.S. history, but it's been among a very small, select population. But I think that we'll see that expand. So in many ways, the kind of thing that we see as a shift in population within the United States, we might see that shifting across borders. So, for example, we have seen the so-called moving toward, at one period in our history, southern people in the southern part of the country moving toward the north for a better life. And now we're beginning to see in the 21st century, there is some of that is a shift at moving toward the south as a better place. So I understand, for example, Atlanta is now the new Mecca for a lot of, let's say, African Americans, whereas the North used to be the Mecca for the so-called Great Migration of African Americans.
Right. So, and of course, your argument is that if the educational system doesn't get right in the long term, you could see migration out.
Oh, absolutely. That's the point. So I was using that as an example that while this population was moving around the country, I think we're going to see is that in the long run, if something radically different does not happen in the United States, people are going to find ways to move out of the United States into other places.
We're joined today by an expert in multicultural education, Geneva Gay, professor of curriculum and instruction at the University of Washington at Seattle. Thank you so much for joining us today on Central Standard, Professor.
It's been a delight. Thank you.
And tune in tomorrow for ideas of how to bring the taste of spring into your kitchen and onto your plate, including a recipe for asparagus and potato salad with mint and lemon dressing. Yum. Our show is produced by Andrea Salenzi with help from Charlie Upchurch. Up to Date is next with a conversation about the Supreme Court's decision on the Accountable Care Act. I'm Jabalani LaFall, and this is Central Standard. Enjoy your day.